Good morning. It's Friday, May 25th. Next week, the Jefferson Davis State Historic Site in Fairview hosts a commemoration of the Western Kentuckian who became the first and only president of the Confederate States of America on the occasion of his 204th birthday. We'll speak with historian William C. Davis, no relation, about the rebel leader's life and legacy today on Front Page AM from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to Front Page AM. June 3rd marks the 204th birthday of one of the only two native Kentuckians to hold an American presidency. One is, of course, Abraham Lincoln, and the other is his Civil War counterpart, Confederate President Jefferson Davis. Davis was born in Fairview, in what was then Christian County, now Todd, in 1808. Beginning June 1st and running through the 3rd, the Jefferson Davis Birthplace State Historic Site will host a commemoration of the former U.S. Senator and rebel president. There will be exhibits, activities, and Civil War reenactors. But given Davis's place in American history, the question arises as to whether he is someone to be commemorated. For some insight into that question, we turn to Virginia Tech history professor and Civil War scholar William C. Davis, who is no relation. Davis is the author of Jefferson Davis, The Man and His Hour, and Look Away, A History of the Confederate States of America. I'd like to begin by asking about the image we have today of Jefferson Davis. How is he viewed in the 21st century South, and how does that compare with the way the rest of the country sees him?
I'm not really certain that the average American today really has any image of Jefferson Davis. He's a kind of an unknown quantity to people today, very much as he was in his own time. If anything, I suspect the view is of a tall, stern, very distant sort of person who maybe had something to do with causing the Confederacy to lose its bid for independence, which is not unlike the view a lot of people had of him 150 years ago.
One of the impressions that's come down to us today is of a cold, officious man, as you allude to, but one that had to have been affected by the death of his first wife, Sarah Knox Taylor, at a very young age, and by the deaths of some of his children. How are those sides reconciled?
There's no question, in my mind at any rate, that Davis's personality was heavily formed by all the losses of loved ones in his life, most notably his first wife, Sarah Knox Taylor, who I'm convinced was really the love of his life. He had to wait quite a while through courtship to be allowed to marry her, and then when he did, he persuaded her to go south to his plantation in Mississippi during the malaria season by telling her that it would be perfectly safe, even though he knew it wasn't. And, of course, within a matter of a few weeks, both of them are afflicted with malaria, and she dies, I think. Davis never said anything about feeling guilty over that, but I don't see how he could not have felt guilty of it over it for the rest of his life. And there's no question that his personality underwent a change. He was a fun-loving and almost impish young man before her death. Indeed, at West Point, he'd been virtually a party boy. But after her death, he became very serious, sober, morose, and is really never the same individual. And then add to that, when he marries his second wife, Davis will have four sons, and he outlives all four of them. That's a tremendous amount of loss for a man to suffer. And that's one of the reasons, I think, indeed, that he was perhaps the last ever to accept that the Confederacy was beaten in 1865. It was unthinkable to him that this nation, which I think he viewed very much like another one of his sons, that he could no more get it into his head to peacefully preside over its demise than he could watch another one of his sons die.
That leads to the next question, is how we square the impressions of former Senator Davis, who accepted the Confederate presidency a bit unwillingly, with that Davis who was captured in Georgia in 1865, who was apparently bent on continuing the war at all costs.
Yeah, I think by the beginning of 1865, certainly for most Confederates, the re-election of Abraham Lincoln was the handwriting on the wall, that the North was willing to stick with this war for another 4 years if it had to. Most thinking people's judgment told them that the longer the war went on, the less chance there was of the South winning. Even Davis himself early on had said that their best hope of winning was that the North would be willing to lose. The election of Lincoln put the quietus to that. But Davis just seemed to refuse to see it. I think by the spring of 1865, he's occasionally what we would today call delusional. It's always dangerous to try to put somebody on the couch when they're not there to speak for themselves. But I think Davis's unrealistic expectations, especially in April in 1865, indicate that he simply wasn't thinking very clearly. He had notions of somehow fleeing across the deep south through Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, even into Louisiana, and that phantom legions of Confederate men who had either not come forward to enlist or who had deserted or who had left the army because they were in poor health would somehow flock to his banner with weapons, and a new army would coalesce around him that he would then lead back to win all that was lost and gain their independence. Chimerical pipe dream at that point.
What is Jefferson Davis's legacy today, 150 years out, and is it one we should be commemorating? I mean, I use that word specifically because that the event that is in Fairview next week is called a commemoration.
I think it's worthwhile for people to understand at least something about Jefferson Davis because it can help them understand the Confederacy itself and what led to the Civil War that is still defining us today. It's too easy to dismiss the Confederates as arch pro-slave people who are somehow sort of radically dedicated to destroying the Union. They were genuinely a people who were caught in a bind, one of those rock and hard places that history simply throws at people, that slavery was an accomplished fact and it was lawful where it then existed. They had very good reason to fear that the way federal legislation was going could one day lead to an assault upon slavery where it existed, which would have eradicated about $4 billion worth of capital investment in the South, the largest single form of property there was. Virtually not just Southern economy, but Southern society was in danger of collapse if slavery collapsed. And Davis is one of those people who accepted the thankless and probably no-win task of trying to stand up for their view of rights when they clashed with the view of the rights of Americans. Davis, I think, deserves some respect. I think, personally, I would not have liked the man if I met him just because of his personality. But I feel a lot of empathy for him, for the task he was given, the way he threw himself into it to the exclusion of virtually every other aspect of his life, including his health. And he's a man who stood up for what he believed and sacrificed almost everything for it. And we should all at least be able to respect, if not admire, that.
I get the feeling that you still believe he's very much relevant today. But that leads me to wonder if there was one thing that people really should know about Jefferson Davis, what would that be?
I guess my answer to that would be something on the micro scale rather than the macro. Because of this image that I mentioned at the very beginning of this cold, aloof, austere man, the thing I like best about Davis is that he became absolutely foolish in the presence of children. He just loved children because he'd lost so many of his own, I suppose. They are the only people with whom he was ever, I think, completely at ease. My guess is because in his time and place, children, blacks, and women were the social inferiors of an adult white male, so they couldn't challenge him. But with children especially, he just become almost goofy. He just loved to play with them. The last Christmas in the Confederate White House in 1864, there's a wonderful account by his wife, Verena, of him trying to pass out the presents to neighborhood children, and how he got it all messed up and confused, and he tangled up in the tree decorations and everything else. But he was just having so much fun. And it's fun is not a word anyone really associates with Jefferson Davis.
Professor Davis, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Kentucky's commemoration of Jefferson Davis takes place June 1st through the 3rd at the Jefferson Davis State Historic Site in Fairview. Every spring, Marshall County plays host to one of the longest indigenous singing events in the country. The annual Big Singing is a tradition that has stayed largely the same since the 1800s. Rose Kristen Presson explores the history and significance of Marshall County's Big Singing.
Long as I can remember,
it's Monday night in Marshall County's courthouse. 10 people sit in the circuit courtroom, benches and seats and portraits of past clerks around them as they practice.
See, you've got four beats there on that.
That's Gene Gilliland. He's helping to lead some newcomers to the style of singing. It's called shape note singing. Remember the Sound of Music? Well, this type of singing only uses mi, fa, so, and la. And to annotate each syllable, there's a shape. Gene Gilliland explains how he was taught to interpret them.
He says, fa is shaped like an arrow that's pointing far away. He says, so is round like a seed that you sow. He said, mi is shaped like a diamond that I want to give me. And as a good Baptist, he said, and law is square and rigid. There is no grace in law.
Shape note singing was popular in New England a few centuries ago. There's little evidence of it, though, because many traditions are passed down orally. But one of the few books of shape note singing is called Southern Harmony, and that's what they use at Benton's Big Singing. The Southern Harmony book came to Western Kentucky when a family by the name of Lemon moved in covered wagon from North Carolina to Marshall County. One of the kids, James, decided to continue singing hymns from the book well into his adulthood. That became the Big Singing. Ralph Paris is leading much of the practice tonight. He's the director at large of the Association for the Preservation of Southern Harmony Singing. He's come to all but two of the Big Singings since 1960. Paris says his favorite part of the Big Singing now is the more challenging songs.
At Big Singing, there'll be someone from somewhere, and he'll pick a selection that no one's ever tried it before. So just the exercise of learning that from ground zero and then testing your note reading skills is what I enjoy.
Today, more outsiders and locals come to Big Singing. Gilliland says it's mostly populated by musicologists and hymnologists because
the National Music Council said that the Big Singing that we have here started back in 1884 is the longest indigenous musical tradition in the nation. So it has a unique place in music history.
Dr. Stephen Sheeran is a professor of musicology at Middle Tennessee State University. He's attended a few of Benton's Big Singings. He says his first time was on a road trip while he was an undergrad at Northwestern University in the 70s.
For me, it was in part homesickness for the South generally. But also I was attracted to the music, to the community, and to the experience, both as a musician and a Southerner, and as a sort of a born-ing historian.
Sheeran specializes in Southern harmony and sacred harp music, both Southern Christian a cappella styles, and says regional culture and history manages to be preserved in the music. He says the Big Singing in Benton was, for decades, the only known place in the U.S. where this music was sung. For Sheeran, the Big Singing wasn't like anything he'd seen before as a music student.
They invited us into the area with the singers there around the bench in the courthouse, and we were allowed to lead, and this was very unusual at that time.
Really, anyone can lead. The way shape note singing works is that the leader defines the pitch. The whole group sings the song in syllables. And then the group sings the lyrics in unison. And when a few hundred more people join in on Sunday, it'll sound more like. For WKMS News, I'm Rose Kristen Presson.
This year's Big Singing is taking place Sunday the 27th in the Marshall County Courthouse in Benton's downtown square. It's free and the public is welcome anytime between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. I'm Todd Hatton and you've been listening to Front Page AM. This is the final edition of the program and we are also retiring Front Page PM this evening at 6:30 after Marketplace. Chad Lampe speaks to 4th District State Representative Mike Cherry, who is retiring himself after 13 years in Frankfort. Front Page Sunday, however, is not retiring. You'll still be able to catch our hour-long regional news magazine Sunday mornings at 9. If you'd like to hear any of our stories again, we have them online at news.wkms.org. The Marketplace Morning Report is next.
Support for 91.3 WKMS comes from contributing listeners and the Purchase Area Development District on Medical Drive in Mayfield. Monday, June 11th from 9:30 to 3, they host a free volunteer counselor recruitment and orientation for the State Health Insurance Assistance Program. SHIP supports individuals and caregivers who receive state health benefits. Reservations and information at 877-352-5183. And support for the Marketplace Morning Report comes from the Paducah Office of Wells Fargo Advisors, investment and planning professionals proudly serving Paducah area investors. Member SIPC. It's 8:51.